Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today will be no stranger to anyone who is part of the appellate Twitter community. He is known as the Dean there. But if you're a member of the Texas Bar, you may have seen some of his CLEs, particularly on legal writing, or his mostly weekly newsletter on the Fifth Circuit. It is Rafi Malkonian, an appellate lawyer in Houston. So Rafi, welcome, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Jody and Todd. It's really great to be on.
We're really glad you're here. Just to kind of start out, for those who maybe aren't as familiar with you on Twitter, can you kind of tell us a little bit about what you do and your background, how you got there?
Yeah, sure. As you just said, I'm an appellate lawyer in Houston at the firm of Wright, Close & Barger. You know, we're an appellate firm and we mostly do appeals, though we also have some great trial lawyers. I probably do most of my work in the Fifth Circuit and other federal courts of appeals around the country. That's not a rule. I do some Texas appeals. I do Texas Supreme Court. I do appeals in other courts, other state courts elsewhere. So, but if I had to break down what I do, it's mostly Fifth Circuit work. And in terms of my background, that makes sense because I clerked for the Fifth Circuit. And that's how I ended up in Texas. I was a New York lawyer to begin with, and Judge Jennifer Walker Elrod sort of lured me down here, and she kept me here because I loved it when I got used to Texas. And it's been a great, 7 years now that we've moved here.
And you actually didn't start out doing appeals. In fact, you started kind of a very different career path. How did you end up finding your way into appeals? What changed, I guess?
Yeah, I have a pretty strange career path for an appellate lawyer, I guess, which is that in law school, I thought I would be a mergers and acquisitions lawyer, you know, doing transactions, mostly in New York or London or something like that. And so I took all these corporations courses in law school, and then I clerked for the Delaware Court of Chancery right out of law school, which was the same theory. I was going to be this corporate lawyer. And then I went to the New York law firm of Cravath, Swain & Moore, where they do a lot of corporate law, and I did some M&A for 2.5 years. The big realization is that I am very bad at it, really terrible. So, you know, I think what had been driving it is that I thought it was exciting, that kind of work, and also, if I'm being honest with myself, you know, kind of Scrooge McDuck swimming around in vats of money images. It turns out the day-to-day work, being an M&A lawyer, is not at all like that. It's very detail-oriented. It's intense pressure. And you've just got to really be able to coordinate tons of people on a lot of stuff for days and days. I'm really bad at that. Totally awful. So I was pretty miserable doing that. And while I was in the middle of that misery, I thought about, well, what should I do? And some professors in law school had told me that, you know, you'd make a pretty good appellate lawyer. And at the time, I sort of mocked them because I was like, no, I'm doing the corporate law Scrooge McDuck thing. And they were right, of course. I had no business doing that at all. And so I started thinking about how to accomplish becoming an appellate lawyer. And I took two big steps, I think. One is that I asked my law firm to move me over to litigation, which is pretty unusual, but they did it after sort of a bunch of begging. And the second thing is I applied to federal appellate clerkships because I thought, like, how else am I going to signal to potential employers that I'm really an appellate lawyer? And I thought, well, clerkship could be that kind of pivot. So I applied to, it must have been 100 appellate judges across the country. I was very fortunate to get an interview with Judge Elrod, and that the interview went well, and I had a great year, and you know, here we are.
So that's sort of a non-traditional clerkship path. I mean, you hear about career law clerks and Supreme Court clerks coming in after some practice experience, but you actually went back and got that judicial clerk experience after having been in practice for a while. How long had you practiced before doing that?
I'd been out for 5 years, including the first clerkship.
And I know that that's something that you're very vocal about for lawyers, is if you are trying something and you're miserable, then don't be afraid to try something different, you know? And I think that that's great that you're out there advocating that, because I think that is important, because, you know, I certainly didn't know, looking back, getting out of law school, that I'd be doing what I do today. It's wildly different than what I expected. And I think a lot of people are in that boat. You know, you have one, maybe 2 years in law school to really decide what you want to do, you feel like, and then you're locked in for the rest of your life. But that's not always the case.
No, and law is so big that you can really find a niche that you love. And it doesn't have to be appellate practice. I mean, we're all appellate lawyers, but it could be anything. And you could end up just loving it and getting really deeply embedded in it in a way that the other thing you were doing, you hated. And they're both law. And you can, you know, you just have to find the thing that makes you happy if you can.
I know a lot of our lawyer brothers and sisters have a hard time finding that thing. And it's great to, I think, for the three of us all to have found it. And know now at this point, you know, some of us take a little more circuitous route to get here, but that we're doing what we enjoy doing, because I think we can all agree that this appellate practice is the best practice area, but particularly among litigation practices.
I mean, of course, it's self-serving, but yes, that's true.
I think the three of us agree. I don't know that some of my litigation people that I work with would agree, because the last thing they want to do is sit at a computer all day and read cases, whereas that's kind of my perfect day most of the time, especially lately since I've been working from home.
Oh, yeah. Fits great for the work at home model. Absolutely.
Right.
As long as you can find the quiet time, that's the challenge, right?
Yep. So let's switch gears a little bit. I think one of the things that you are most well known for is your presence on Twitter. One of the things I think you're known for is social media, which is something that you've been doing for a long time. Can you kind of tell us about how you got into social media, and maybe more particularly into Twitter and the creation of appellate Twitter, the phenomenon that exists today?
Yeah, sure. So I have been involved on the internet for a very long time, even before I think people called it social media. But I was one of the original crop of law school bloggers that sort of arose in 2002, 2003. And I had a 1L law blog that I wrote when I was a law student that sort of was, it was anonymous, though everyone apparently figured out who I was very quickly. And I just sort of wrote about, you know, going to class, exams, the professors, that kind of stuff. I thought I was writing kind of a 1L, the book. I guess it was Scott Turow or whoever wrote that book back in the day. So that's how I started. And I kept doing that until my clerkship when, you know, the judge told me to knock it off, which I did. And then when I was at Cravath, I didn't do any blogging because I was too busy. So when I made this transition to appellate practice, I would kind of miss the interaction online with people, because even back in the blogging days, there was a lot of commentary. You know, people could post comments under the blogs and you would respond, and blogs would fight with each other, hopefully civilly, but sometimes not. So I started looking around for what that outlet was going to be in the modern world. It turned out that that was Twitter. I went on Twitter, and then I thought, well, I need to find some appellate lawyers. And so I started searching around, and I found a bunch to begin with, including, I think the very first one I found was Jason Steed, a fellow Texas appellate lawyer, whose handle I think is Fifth Circuit Appeals. And so I thought, this guy must be someone I want to talk to. And Jason led me to a lot of the other people that I've gotten to know so well over the last few years, you know, including you all, but also the folks in DC, like Sean Barada and Jamie Santos and all those kind of people that have such a big presence on Twitter.
Well, I think you're underselling yourself a little bit, Rafi, because I think a lot of folks who are listening today will know you as the dean of appellate Twitter, the hashtag. You want to tell us a little bit about how that phenomenon got started?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was definitely an accident. So again, I was looking around for something to do on Twitter with appellate practice, and I was getting to know these appellate lawyers across the country. And it turned out a few of them were having lunch in DC, I think at a Texas barbecue restaurant. And I was kind of jealous of them. I wished I was there. So these cool people that I've been reading about online. And so I tweeted something like, "We in the provinces are jealous, hashtag appellate Twitter." And for whatever reason, that struck a chord. And now for 4 or 5 years or 3 years, whatever it is, people have been using the hashtag to organize a lot of discussions about appellate practice and judging and those kind of really interesting topics. And it's been amazing from my perspective in terms of letting me interact with great lawyers around the country and making friends. It's invaluable to me.
Yeah, kind of following you, it's interesting to see all the experiences you've had. I think the places you've gone, the people that you've interacted with, kind of the things that you've gotten to do. It's really cool that what started as essentially a little bit of a joke on social media turned into that. It's sort of like this podcast almost. That's kind of how we got started. A joke on a tweet kind of got turned into something. And here we are, however many episodes later, doing this.
Were you joking?
I was halfway joking before, and then Blake Hawthorne kind of pushed me into actually being serious, and you know, here we are. So it's funny how that all works.
There's a lot of serendipity in social media, it seems. My tweet that has the most likes ever, it's something like 20,000 likes now, is literally the word "what" with 3 question marks. There's no originality in it. There's nothing. And yet that one caught fire. And hashtag appellate Twitter is a bit like that. There's no reason why it ought to have caught fire the way it did, or it ought to have organized all these people into chatting about appellate practice, but it did, and it's great.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting community, and we were talking to Kendall Hanks and Kristen Vanderplas last week about this, and it's amazing that you have this little corner of Twitter, which can frankly be a cesspool if you dwell in the wrong areas, where you really have great supportive people who want to meet up in person and share tips and share work. And, you know, that's not something that's a common social media story. It's really kind of cool that it exists.
No, it really isn't that common that people would be so friendly and helpful, but it's been amazing. I mean, the kinds of help I've gotten from social media, even in my practice over the last few years, is just mind-boggling. Like, I would never have told you that you get that kind of just pro bono, free assistance on questions I might have, or people to bounce ideas off. It's really been remarkable.
This ties back into the point I made earlier about appellate practice being the best at litigation practice, because that's really consistent with the overall sort of feeling of collegiality that you have among appellate lawyers. To those of us that are in it all the time, if you don't have a great knowledge of Twitter and how it can be a cesspool in places, it would really be no surprise that we would have that sort of collegiality going on in appellate Twitter. But I think that's one of the things that really makes it stand out. The whole appellate Twitter hashtag phenomenon is primarily you, Rafi, are showing to the world, and you know, through the things that you've helped develop, you know, there really is another way of communicating on Twitter and approaching social media generally than just trolling and doing things that are really just mindless and stupid. Can be a very positive experience.
It can. And we have to remember that it has to be intentional. Like, if you don't think about making it positive every time you're on there, it can degenerate really quickly, because just like anyone else, you know, your temper might get riled up and you might want to respond to that person who's calling you a name or saying something bad about you or the kinds of things you're saying. And you've just got to really intentionally refuse to do that to the extent you can. It doesn't work every time. Obviously, sometimes things slip out. But if you do that and you try to commit to helping others and being friendly on Twitter, it can be positive. Now, that's not true for most of it, but you know, we just have to do our best.
And more broadly speaking, that also sort of is a microcosm of the practice of law in general, particularly litigation practice. As appellate, it's not quite as bad, but you have those same interactions with litigators, whether by email, on the phone, by letters, paper in the file, back and forth. And it's always important to remember that, to be intentional about how you respond to those things. Because we've all seen on Above the Law when they've gotten completely out of hand and then ended up in front of a judge.
And especially in our community, you know, the Texas appellate community, you're going to run into that person again.
No question.
It's a small world, and you're going to be litigating with these people, maybe on their side, maybe against them, for many years. So there's just no reason to be, you know, uncivil.
Let's switch gears a little bit. I saw that you had a very important anniversary this week of something that got you a lot of coverage on social media and beyond. You argued your first Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court argument just a year ago this week, right?
Yes, that's right.
Tell us a little bit about what it was like to be a first-time advocate at the United States Supreme Court.
Well, let me jump back to something we were just talking about, because there, that is also a very collegial appellate bar up there that works on the Supreme Court. Now, I've heard from some people that, you know, it can have sharp elbows at times, and I'm sure that's true. These are all very important and brilliant Supreme Court lawyers. But in my, the experience I had was unbelievably positive. The just spontaneous outpouring of help for me, the kindness, including from our opponents at Hogan Lovells, including, you know, Neil Cantillo. I thought it was a remarkable experience just from that perspective. The fact that everyone was interested in helping me do a good job at that court, even though they might be against me or they don't like what I was advocating. So that alone was just unbelievable to experience.
You were the respondent, right? Which is not always the place you want to be when you've got a cert granted at the Supreme Court.
It was definitely not where we wanted to be. We vociferously argued to deny the petition, but it was granted, you know, over our objections. And, you know, there's a real perverse incentive there. So, like, of course I wanted to argue at the Supreme Court. Every appellate lawyer, I think, has that somewhere in the back of their head. Mm-hmm. But for my client, it would be better to have had that petition denied. Like, we would have had resolved that case some years ago now. And so we really did do our best to try to get the thing thrown out, but it didn't. And so I got to have this extraordinary experience that I think I'll have again, but I don't mind. I mean, once it's fine. And I'll, you know, proudly carry my quills around to the end of time.
What was the preparation process like? I know it's different than you would do in your typical appeal, at least from what I saw with you and other people that I've talked to. How did you go about preparing that you kind of feel like was different than you would in a normal case?
Well, there were two things at work there. One is the preparation for everybody, I think, is more intense for a Supreme Court argument and briefing than for any other kind of briefing or argument. But also, you know, as a first timer, I thought I cannot be embarrassed up there. Like, no matter what, I'm going to do this argument and people are not going to say he didn't know. So I took it perhaps to maybe too far, but I thought I was going to do everything I could possibly do to be ready for them. So what it amounted to is I put aside about 2 months to prepare for the argument. Not every single day, not 8 hours a day, but like I was doing something for the argument for about 2 months. And of course, there's briefing going on at the same time. So there's a lot of work going on in that. I did 4 moot courts. 3 of them, well, no, 2 of them were outside DC. And then I did 2 in Washington, DC, right before the argument. I, you know, prepared, I mean, a lot of things. I could talk about it for an hour, I think. But I, just as an example, I prepared 200 or 300 note cards of questions the Supreme Court might ask me. And then on the other side, I scribbled what the answer was. And I would just go through them every day again and again, asking myself those questions, improving the answer, scribbling more stuff on the other side. You know, I took pictures of myself giving the answers to the questions, which got memed on appellate Twitter. You know, it was just an all-consuming, intense experience to get ready for it, in part driven by my own anxiety that I would do a good job, but also that just the thing is like that.
It's sure
consuming.
I think one issue would be you don't really know what level of preparation is adequate. And so it would seem like you would tend to over-prepare just because of the size of the stage and, you know, the significance of that. I'm sure there's no doubt you were over-prepared based on what you described. That's just incredible. I love the note cards idea. You know, I think we all, no matter what court we're arguing in, we probably try and anticipate questions that we're going to get from the bench. And that's like a strategy that you might have used, you know, studying for the bar exam or something, just to be able to have that instant recall of an answer to a question that you might get hit with at any time in the argument. I really love that idea. I might have to steal that one for my next argument.
Well, I ordered David Frederick's book on preparing for oral argument in the Supreme Court at the beginning of the process. And on one of the very first pages, it says, not all advocates faint at their Supreme Court argument or something. I was like, well, if that's the standard, I really need to get on this because, like, if that's the intensity. But in that book, it does recommend, you know, writing out questions and asking them to yourself in random order. And I thought the way to do that is, you know, note cards that I would shuffle and read to myself and then try to answer. Or I had my wife read them to me. I even had my, at the time, 6-year-old son try to read some of them to me. Just anyone who could yell things at me.
Did you have him do it in different voices for the different justices?
I didn't get that advanced. Maybe next time.
Okay. Yeah. It's a good plan to have. How did you feel the oral argument went after all that preparation?
I mean, I actually said this week on Twitter. The oral argument, I was not nervous about at all by the time we got to, because the moots were so intense, especially the Georgetown Clinic moot, which is like the keystone moot for preparing for the Supreme Court. It's allocated to one of the two sides. You flip a coin to get it. They get 5 really high-level Supreme Court practitioners, and they just hammer you for 2 hours. So once you've done the Georgetown moot, and if it goes well, you have nothing to fear from the Supreme Court argument. And I had these 3 other moots. I was extremely prepared. What really stressed me out was making sure my friends had seats. My law partners, my family, my client. The Supreme Court only allocated us 7 seats. We had all those people I just mentioned, plus the team from Stanford Law School, which had helped us prepare the brief and prepare for the argument. And that was a complete panic. I've analogized it over the last year to being like the practice squad defensive back that the team goes to the Super Bowl and you know, like, you're out of place, but you've got to get everyone into the game. So you're just like frantically buying tickets on StubHub. There's no StubHub for the Supreme Court, but it was kind of like that. So that stressed me out way more than the argument by time all the preparation.
Did you manage to get seats for everybody that wanted them?
Everybody. My partner, Russ Hollenbeck, had to beg the marshal of the Supreme Court for a seat for his son. And the marshal took his teenage son and put him in the attorney lounge during the first argument, then stuffed him into the courtroom during the second. We don't even know how he
put him into the courtroom.
And so it worked out. But I think almost everybody that wanted to get in got in. We had a few people turned away, but, you know, that's just going to happen. There were really not that many seats.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, you see the pictures and then you actually see it in person and it ends up being a very small courtroom compared to what your impression is seeing the building from the outside.
Oh, yeah. And it's very cramped. Like, everyone is sitting right next to you. So,
you know, it's been in the news lately about, obviously, we're still on a lockdown for the coronavirus. The courts are trying to carry on their business as best they can. And the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, has heard, I'm not sure they've already heard them or they're going to hear telephonic arguments.
They're going to hear them.
Yeah. I didn't think it had come up just yet, but that's an interesting, it seemed to me that was an interesting approach to having an argument in the age of video. And I know that the court is famous for not allowing cameras in the Supreme Court courtroom, but it kind of seemed like maybe this was the time to have a Supreme Court oral argument over video. And we've seen the Texas Supreme Court lead the way on that by having a Zoom argument. What do you think about video in the U.S. Supreme Court? Would this have been the right time to do it? And why do you think the court is still holding steadfast to not doing video?
Well, I think the idea of having a telephonic argument in the U.S. Supreme Court, it's just not going to go well. I mean, maybe it will because the lawyers are so good and the justices are good and everything. But the sort of unique aspect of the Supreme Court is that often the advocate is not really arguing to the Supreme Court. What you're really doing is mediating a discussion between the justices because they've never talked to each other before about the case. You know, when they sit up there, that's the first time they've had any interaction with each other about your matter. And so they're talking to each other and you're just kind of there directing traffic. I don't know how you do that on phone. Like, when I was up there, I would see Justice Breyer sort of sit up to ask me a question. And then on the other side, Justice Alito was wanting to say something. And so you'd look at Chief Justice Roberts and he would kind of figure out who to, you know, turn to. And then you'd have to remember that Alito wanted to talk. So you'd have to go back to him. I don't know how you do any of that on the phone. And I don't know how they're going to handle it. I know that they're going to think really hard about that question. So, you know, so maybe they'll come up with some answer. But I think just as an advocate, it's impossible. So I think video would have been way better. Obviously, the problem is they don't want to be on video. They don't want their faces in public. They don't want to be recognizable. Maybe sensibly think that people will sort of try to hot dog if there's video recording of these arguments. I don't think it's a problem. As all of us watch the Texas Supreme Court, it's never really happened, as far as I can tell, that people try to make rhetorical points so that they can get it on video. But the U.S. Supreme Court's very conservative about it. I don't think they're going to be doing it.
I figure they'll probably do rotary phone for their phone arguments. Got to dial in with the clicks, maybe call the operator, have them patch you in.
Yeah. Oh, that's certainly going to be happening.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation about how's the traffic going to be directed?
Yeah.
On a call like that. I would hope that, you know, in light of how things have gone with other, at least state high courts, with Zoom arguments being really pretty successful, that the U.S. Supreme Court would rethink that, but I don't think that's going to happen. Yeah. I think we're going to wait for all this to pass and resume handling arguments in person, just like they always have. It does seem to me, though, Rafi, that, you know, we're kind of in a place where we're adopting some technology in a way that lawyers haven't been forced to do up until now. We're having Zoom hearings, Zoom oral arguments. It seems like it's a good opportunity for courts to adopt technologically. It's just unfortunate that the Supreme Court, but if the concern really is that they don't want people to grandstand, look at the Texas Supreme Court. We're not seeing that. And so maybe you're right. Maybe it is that they just don't want to be publicly recognizable. And that's a shame because, I mean, they're extremely important figures in American society.
Well, and then put on top of that, the other problem, which we were just discussing, which is that it is nearly impossible to get a seat in the Supreme Court to come watch one of the three branches of the American government function. If you're not part of the bar, you have to go camp out there for a night or two in important cases. They used to allow even people, you could hire people to go sit in line for you. I think they've eliminated that. But nonetheless, like, there is no other way to get at the Supreme Court other than literally showing up in Washington or hearing the audio that they release on Fridays. But that's not the same as being in the court itself. I'll just give a quick story from my experience. I didn't realize this Justice Thomas and Justice Breyer chat the whole argument. And they do that constantly. I really? Read several arguments to get ready. You know, I went to Washington a week in advance, and I went to all the arguments that there were that I could get to. And they chat. Justice Thomas seems to give Justice Breyer notes throughout the argument. Some people have said that those are questions that Thomas would like Breyer to ask on his behalf. So if you don't get that understanding, you know, there's no way to get that from the audio because you can't see in the audio them leaning back and, you know, jabbering or chuckling or whatever else they're doing. And then there's some things you miss on the audio that are really heartwarming. So I think this was reported in the Supreme Court press, but Justice Thomas holds Justice Ginsburg's hand when they leave the bench and takes her down the steps and takes her to the back because she's, you know, frail. And that's just a really nice moment that I don't think people would get from the fact that they're ideological opponents or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so they're supposed to hate each other, I take it from Twitter. But in fact, it's just a very gentle moment that I think people would like to see and like to have some faith that the government is made up of people who are trying to work together. So there's a lot of things missing from the fact that we can't see these justices. I understand the countervailing arguments. It's just, there's some strong arguments on that side too.
Makes me wonder now if the long hypotheticals come from Justice Thomas on a note instead of actually Justice Breyer himself.
Well, they're small notes.
Oh, okay, so it must not be. Those are original.
Yeah.
Or why Justice Thomas doesn't just ask the questions himself.
Right.
You know, as he's known for not speaking during argument, seems like it'd be just as easy to ask himself. These are things that we will never know, I assume. So, Rafi, one thing that we ask all our guests to do, you've already kind of thrown in a couple of war stories, but we wanted to invite you to provide another one, if you like, or a tip or something else. I mean, maybe a tip for folks preparing for the U.S. Supreme Court for the first time, although you've covered that probably already as well. What would you like to tell the listeners?
Let me tell a couple things. One, in terms of a tip, you know, you really should go get some help for the Supreme Court. It doesn't mean you need to give up the oral argument or that you need to give up direction of the brief or writing the brief yourself. But there are a ton of amazing Supreme Court lawyers who are willing to help you and will give you some latitude to take the case yourself, including law schools, professors, small firms, all kinds of people. And the cadence of how you write a Supreme Court brief is so different to me than how I would write a Fifth Circuit brief, that it was incredibly valuable to have that just person to tell me, hey, the Supreme Court doesn't care about that argument you're about to make, so knock it off. Just think about that. If you ever get a case, even just at the cert stage, and you want to oppose the petition, you know, call around these people that you see on SCOTUS blog and appellate Twitter who really know what they're talking about and see if they'll give you a hand. I think it's just an amazing resource. The reason they're going to do that for you, by the way, is that there's so few cases that they're an incredibly valuable commodity for the Supreme Court. So they have an incentive, you have an incentive, it works great. One more story I'd like to throw out. So the Solicitor General of the United States was on our side in Fort Bend County versus Davis because the EEOC essentially had decided that we were right about how the statute worked, the Equal Employment Opportunity. And so, first of all, in order to achieve that, you go to this incredibly intense meeting at the Department of Justice where 20 to 30 lawyers from DOJ show up representing all kinds of agencies and interests. And they sit there and they pepper you for like 2 hours. And I didn't know anything about this thing before we got into the Supreme Court case. But apparently there's just a whole wizardry to how to handle that, you know, how to assuage the concerns of each agency and make sure that they can make the right argument to the Solicitor General, who ultimately makes the decision on which way the U.S. is going to go. So that's one thing I had no idea about. It's probably the most terrifying meeting I've ever been to. But the other thing is I was chatting with the Solicitor General's office about on the day of the oral argument. I had arrived 3 hours in advance because even for someone arguing, you have to stand in all kinds of lines or whatever. And so I said to the lawyer from the SG's office, so when'd you get here? And he said, oh, we drive into the basement. I got here 2 minutes ago. And then they take an elevator into the courtroom. Like, it's astounding. So I guess being a government lawyer gets you some cool benefits. The other note about that is that they do not take their commemorative quills that everyone who argues at the Supreme Court gets because they're too cool for quills because they have so many of them. So you could take their quills. That's another hint I was given by the expert bar in D.C. as I was getting ready.
Extra parting gifts.
That's right.
That's great. Well, Rafi, we want to thank you again for being with us and spending this time with us. And
yes, absolutely.
It's enlightening to hear about that experience. I remember following it at the time and thinking how neat it was that you were getting to do that. It's just great to hear you talk about it. We've talked about Twitter and your presence there, obviously, and we'll put your handle in the show notes, but do you want to give your Twitter handle out to folks so they can, if the listeners want to follow you there?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm at RM Fifth Circuit. That's just spelled out FiftHcircut.
And if you don't already know, if you're listening to this show and you've not checked out the appellate Twitter hashtag, you should definitely do so. We appreciate everybody listening. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit.
And taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great, too. We appreciate everybody who's rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email, message us on Twitter, or reach out through the podcast's Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're all staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.